2 weeks ago, rebels in Sudan took the city of El Fasher from the Sudanese army in an assault so violent that bloodstains could be seen from space. This vicious civil war, fought for 2.5 years between the Sudanese army and rebels known as the RSF, has left at least 150,000 dead, 11 million displaced, and right now 21 million Sudanese in acute hunger. It's by any standards an appalling mess, but what's it about? In a word, gold. As Sudan burns and its people starve, writes Declan Walsh, the Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times, a gold rush is underway. Declan has been covering the war from the start, and he joins us now from Nairobi. Declan, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David. It's good to be here.
Declan, what happened at El Basher?
Well, it was basically the bloody culmination of an 18-month siege. This paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, that's been fighting Sudan's army for control of the country for 2.5 years now. As part of that, it had been laying siege to the city of El Fasher, which was the last remaining obstacle to complete control over Darfur. That's this enormous region in western Sudan. And to press that siege, they had resorted to medieval tactics, really. They ringed the city with a 40-mile-long wall or an earthen berm that prevented food or medicine from getting in or out in the final stages of it. There were drone strikes, artillery, a really punishing siege. And that came to a head a couple of weeks ago when the RSF finally pushed out the last Sudanese soldiers from the city. And what followed was really these, shocking scenes that we've seen coming out on videos, but also through eyewitness testimony of massacres taking place in the city. We've had people who fled the city saying that they were shot at, some of them killed as they tried to leave. They left along these roads that were littered with bodies. The World Health Organization said that over 450 people were killed in a massacre at the city's last remaining hospital. So it's really been, I think we've really just seen these, in some respects, this has been a massacre foretold. Many people who've been watching Sudan closely had been watching with concern the siege of Fasher. But unfortunately, the scenes that have come out of there have, matched those expectations and even gone beyond them.
So Sudan is now effectively split east-west, is that right?
That's right. Largely speaking, the Rapid Support Forces control the western part of the country, and the Sudanese military holds what remains of the capital, Khartoum, which they recaptured last March, and the east of the city along the Red Sea, or the east of the country along the Red Sea.
And there are gold mines in both halves.
Sudan has some of the largest gold deposits in Africa. It's an industry that really took off about 15 years ago when the country's access to oil diminished because the country split in two after South Sudan seceded. Most of the oil fields were in South Sudan or along that border. And so the gold industry has been flourishing for years, but really nothing like we've seen during this war. There are gold deposits across Sudan, this enormous country, the third largest in Africa, and both sides in the war have been exploiting that gold as a way to finance the fight, to sustain their fighters, and in some ways, gold has also shaped the conflict itself as well.
The leader of the RSF took control of one of the biggest mines, you write, back in 2017, so that sort of predates the outbreak of the civil war itself.
Yeah, that's this commander. His name is Mohamed Hamdan, also widely known as Hemeti in Sudan. And he's this paramilitary leader who rose up through the ranks over the last couple of decades in Darfur. He was a commander of the notorious group, the Janjaweed, 20 years ago in Darfur, when there was also a very bloody conflict there. And over the, in the 2010s, he really rose through the ranks. The Janjaweed transformed into this group that is now known as the Rapid Support Forces. And he grew his personal riches and his political and military strength through gold. That started when his forces seized this the country's largest mine in Darfur at a place called Jebel Mara in 2017. And Hemeti used that wealth to expand the strength and the size of his forces, but he also started to build this business empire that extended across everything from real estate to livestock processing, so many different areas, and a lot of it really was rooted in this gold. And then as he grew in strength, he expanded his gold empire inside the country to mines that were really, all across the west of Sudan. At one point, he was working in association with these Russian mercenaries called Wagner. Before the war started, I visited a mine that was operated by Wagner operatives in the north of Sudan. So really, gold has played this central role in the rise of this group and of the political fortunes of its leader, General Hamdan or Hemeti.
How did this tip over into war?
Well, it started really as a power struggle between Hemeti and the leader of the military, General Burhan. Both of these men had seized power together, actually, in a coup in 2021. Just to rewind slightly, Sudan's longtime autocrat Omar Bashir was ousted in these popular protests in 2019. That was really, I was there for that. That was this euphoric moment of hope for many Sudanese because, after decades of autocracy and repression, this man was gone, and Sudanese hoped that they would transition to a democracy. Unfortunately, that dream only really lasted a couple of years because then Hemeti and Burhan, the two most powerful military figures in the country, seized power together. But that alliance slowly unraveled. Tensions between these two men became a sort of reflection of broader tensions inside the Sudanese security forces between these two competing wings. And that eventually spilled over into open fighting on the streets of Khartoum, the capital, in April 2023. But that was really just, that was the starting point for this war. After that, since then, it has metastasized into this much larger war that has encompassed so many other different forces. There's a whole lot of armed groups that have been sort of dormant or semi-dormant across Sudan, sort of holdovers from previous conflicts. Then they got sucked into the conflict. And then most significantly, the war began to draw in foreign powers that started to take sides on one side or the other, funding and arming either side in the war, trying to back a winner, really, but ultimately making it much, much worse and much, much harder to reach reach a ceasefire, let alone any sort of settlement of the conflict itself.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I am talking to Declan Walsh, who is the Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times, stationed in Nairobi. And we're talking about the civil war in Sudan. Declan, all this time, gold is being frantically mined across Sudan. Where does that gold go and who owns it?
So, as in most African countries, the vast majority of Sudan's gold output goes to Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. Dubai is the hub for 90% of all the gold that comes out of Africa. And it's particularly a hub for smuggled gold as well as officially produced gold.
And this gold is not officially produced, I take it, from Sudan.
It's a mix of the two. The country's official gold figures, just the official gold figures for last year, show that about $1.5 billion worth was exported, I think 65 tons. Nearly all of that went to the UAE. At the minimum, at least the same amount was smuggled out. So it's really this multi-billion dollar industry that has grown. The export figures for gold for last year were about 50% more than they were in 2022, the last year just before the war started. So that's really to give you a sense that already this was an important industry in Sudan, and then but since the war, it has really expanded on both sides of the line, it must be said, not just for the RSF, but also for the Sudanese military, which has its own sort of network of mines that it either owns or controls, has purchased over in the east of the country.
And is the prospect of getting hold of the gold the reason why countries are backing not only one side or the other, but I take it some countries are backing both sides?
Yes, I mean, there's so much money involved in this war, and it has, this very sophisticated war economy has grown up, and it has led to these kind of distortions where, for instance, the United Arab Emirates is the main backer of the RSF, even though it denies it. There's been a lot of reporting, there's been testimony from UN inspectors, from American Congress people. Many people have documented how the UAE is backing the RSF on one side of the fight, and yet on the other side of the fight, in the with Sudan's military, the UAE also is the main shareholder in one of the largest industrial gold mines in the country. Similarly, Russia has threw its weight behind the RSF at the start of the war, but now, and indeed had been involved in gold mining, but now is allying itself with Sudan's military on the other side of the war and has been proposing gold deals in exchange for weapons on that side too. I wouldn't say gold is necessarily the driving factor, the single largest driving factor in the war, but it's certainly a very important one. Sudan is this country that has enormous agricultural wealth and great mineral resources, but actually has largely been sort of cash poor, if you like. So gold is really the main source of income for fighters, for these fighting groups on both sides of the war. And it's also provided what they call perverse incentives for all these other actors to profit from the war. And that can be everyone from these, foreign powers that are arming both sides in the war to this extensive array of, kind of warlords and corrupt officials and many other people in the region who take a cut effectively from smuggling Sudanese gold across Sudan's very porous borders and eventually have been, trading it until it eventually reaches the UAE. As part of our reporting last year, we tracked a single shipment of gold that was worth about $25 million as it made its way from these artisanal gold mines in Darfur, really in one of the most remote parts of the country, and it was smuggled across the border into South Sudan. It went on one flight, then on another flight. Then we had documents that showed how a corporate jet, which in fact had been chartered from the US, landed in South Sudan, with assistance from various officials from several different countries. Did a 90-minute turnaround on a runway. All these suitcases filled with gold were loaded onto that plane, and then it took off for the United Arab Emirates, where presumably it vanished into the international gold markets.
Declan is reducing there to a few words a magnificent report that he wrote for the New York Times in December of last year, The Gold Rush at the Heart of a Civil War. It's an extraordinary piece. Declan, there is some prospect at this point, I understand, of a ceasefire, but such prospects have come and gone in the past. What chance do you give it?
I mean, if you were a betting person, you wouldn't put a lot of money on a ceasefire in Sudan right now. But having said that, it is probably the most serious effort at a ceasefire that we've seen since the start of the war. The US had certainly played some role in diplomacy, and they had an envoy under the Biden administration. Trump administration initially didn't seem to show any interest in Sudan at all. But over the last 3 or 4 months, we've seen President Trump's envoy to Africa, Massad Boulos, bring together this group of Arab diplomats from the United Arab Emirates, from Egypt, and from Saudi Arabia. And they've come up with a sort of ceasefire plan in September that initially just looked like a paper proposal. But in recent weeks, there's been a number of meetings seem to push that idea forward. The RSF say that they're willing to go ahead with this ceasefire. The other side, they'll say that they're not. And I think the reality is that these terrible scenes that we're seeing out of El Fasher and the kind of outrage that they are generating, not just across the region here, but really, I think, across the world because of the videos that are coming out showing these terrible atrocities. I think that's putting pressure on the RSF to at least appear to make a concession. But as I said at the outset, you know, whether that's going to lead to a ceasefire, I mean, there's a long and sorry history of failed efforts over the last 2 years. So you'd be right to be skeptical. But I think people are so desperate at this point that they will cling to whatever hope they can get.
The United States has sanctioned various players in all of this mess, hasn't it? Has that yielded any kind of results?
Very hard to say. I mean, the U.S. has sanctioned at this point all of the principals in the war. You know, the leaders of both factions of the military and the RSF are both under American sanctions at the moment. In fact, the U.S. also made an official designation of genocide against the RSF and Hemeti last January. They've also imposed sanctions on trading companies in the UAE that are used by the RSF, not just to trade gold, but also to run this broader commercial empire and to acquire weapons, vehicles, things like that through the UAE. But on the ground, we've really not seen much evidence that these sanctions have had a significant impact. And in fact, a couple of weeks ago, we saw senior RSF leaders who are under American sanctions turn up in Washington, staying in some of the fanciest hotels in the city as part of these efforts to breach a peace deal. Now, of course, you know, diplomats would argue that, you know, you have to bring in the people who are responsible for the violence in order to make peace. But it's certainly a jarring sight to see that, you know, the U.S. earlier had imposed these sanctions on individuals ostensibly as a way of isolating them, and yet they seem to be able to, you know, stay at the Waldorf Hotel in Washington and move freely through the world, even as the fighting continues, even as we see some of the scenes that we've seen coming out of Fasher.
Even if there were some sort of peace deal here, would it involve the Hemeti family giving up their immense gold holdings, or is that now forever? Do we have this immensely rich family with all of these mines at their disposal?
It seems that it would be inevitable that, you know, control over gold would be part of any settlement in the country, even though what that might look like at this stage is really hard to say. You know, at one point there were suggestions from diplomats that if a peace deal could be struck, that perhaps, you know, the Hemeti and his family would perhaps move abroad to somewhere like the UAE and run their business from there. But, you know, Hemeti and his family have made it clear that they wish to stay in Sudan, that they are from Darfur, that they want to build their political base around there, and they actually, of course, aspire to control of the entire country. So there's little sign that they would be willing to do that. But as probably the single largest, certainly the greatest source of exports that Sudan has, and one of the single largest drivers of the economy, there's no doubt that, you know, gold will be a crucial part of any future negotiations over where Sudan goes in any kind of peace dispensation.
The UN Human Rights Council is holding, I understand, an emergency meeting on Sudan this Friday. What's that about? What can be expected from that?
Well, again, this is just another measure of the outrage that, you know, that the scenes out of Fasher are generating. In the past, we've seen some of these sessions before. At other points in the war, there was an earlier massacre of between 10 and 15,000 people in another part of Darfur at the end of 2023. But we've often seen, you know, the Human Rights Council become divided on partisan lines. We've seen Sudan's military, which controls the official government, trying to block certain resolutions that might be critical of it. We've seen some of these foreign sponsors, like the Emirates or like the Saudis or others, in the war, you know, using their votes in order to favor their proxy or to criticize the other side. But I think, you know, the net effect of it will be that it's going to bring more attention and probably, I would say, you know, a greater, a more concerted level of international political attention on this conflict than we've seen in the past. Because part of the problem for those trying to bring peace to Sudan is that the conflict, even though it's been going on for the last 2.5 years, as you said in your introduction, you know, the scale and the level of human suffering has really been immense. In fact, it's the world's largest humanitarian crisis. But it has consistently been overshadowed by the conflicts in Gaza and in Ukraine, and it has really struggled to gain traction internationally or to get political momentum for a solution. So I think that the meeting at the UN will probably be one small step towards the Sudanese conflict rising a little bit higher on the international agenda, hopefully towards some sort of, you know, international coordination over the diplomacy at least.
Declan, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
It was a pleasure.
I've been talking to Declan Walsh, Africa Bureau Chief of the New York Times, about the civil war in Sudan. And Declan has a podcast about Sudan's gold and its role in the war coming out on the New York Times podcast. This is Late Night Live.